right, we'll get started with the Q&A here. Question and answer time. If you've been to Cafe Sai before, we're going to switch things up a little bit today for our Q&A. We're going to test this out, see how it works. We might go back to the old way if it fails, but we're going to try it out anyway. We have a microphone set up on the microphone stand where Amanda is modeling. So if you have a question, you can form... Very good, Amanda. Thank you. You can form a line by the microphone, ask your question, and then get your answer. If you can't get to the microphone, you can still kind of flag us down, and we'll bring it to you if that becomes necessary. But we'll try that out. We'll keep the microphone stationary. You can ask your questions. All right. So we are recording questions as well for the podcast, so please speak into the microphone nice and loud so everybody can hear your question to make it a little bit easier and so we can have it for the recording as well. All right. So we'll have...
I will start us off with someone who is unable to come down.
All right. And I'll turn it back over to Dr. Watson.
Elementary. I'll say it for you.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now? That's a fitting equation for the digital age. Yes.
First of all, thank you for that lovely, entertaining, and informative presentation. And what I heard, I mean, it's fabulous. It's spectacular. And what I heard you say was that if I didn't have to come to the office and drive through the tunnels, I'd save money. I might save my life. But... how is that impacting the cost of what I have to pay for insurance? I understand how it impacts the rest of my budget, but how does all that affect the cost of health care? And what does that have to do with managing chronic care? I mean, managing to the point where that 75% gets reduced to 25%, which I think it can happen.
Great question. So what for telemedicine? It's cool, you can do it, great. For chronic diseases, I was consulted on a patient that's morbidly obese, has Lynch syndrome, which has predisposition to colorectal cancer, has a behavioral problem, my hairs are addicted to narcotics, and this is a while ago, and then had another associated disease. So by default, that person needs 7 specialists. There is no way that patient could ever get team-based care in the current healthcare system. Was a great-great-great-grandfather, Sinchfield, was the Mayo Clinic's first partner. It used to be Mayo, and Sinchfield. But they hired him because he would go to the communities. They assumed he was a good physician, which he was. But they hired him because he was a good physician. And so he was their medical record. He was their health information exchange. He was their home care. He was all of that. He was their pharmacy. He was the whole thing. So that model of healthcare at the home that existed up to around the 1950s or so, we can go back to that model, but with a tremendous amount of sophistication. So the first part is that through medical records, we know who you are. We understand your problem list and your medications. We're still learning this one. I mean, We've made our mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. We're learning. Then, with analytics of the future, you'll be able to understand exactly, predict what's going to happen to you. But the telemedicine piece is critical because if you have, and someone else asked the question about travel. I don't know where she is. She was just here. There she is. Sorry. Right there. I need my glasses, obviously. My Google glasses, I should say. With the telemedicine of the future, or telemedicine we do today, if you have multiple sclerosis, you may not be able to press the accelerator or you may lose your urine in the car. If you have spinal bifida, you may not be able to use your legs. If you have a movement disorder like Parkinson's, you may not be able to drive or may not be legally allowed to drive. And if you have Crohn's disease, your diarrhea may be so bad you may not want to drive. The point is that that is an impediment to healthcare because those populations who are extremely expensive and some of the hardest chronic diseases like our dual eligibles can't travel. And so this is a way of taking the pieces of healthcare to their home. And we actually built a telemedicine platform that we learned from some of our partners where I can see a patient then hand the call off to another provider who can hand the call off and hand the call off. So it doesn't matter if I'm in Oakland, another provider's in the passive in hospital, the third one's in our health plan. I see you at home. I say, your wounds are fine. Let me hand you off to the pharmacist. Are you okay with your medications? who hands it off to the practice-based care manager who says, when's your next appointment? Do you know what's going on? So you bring the team to the patient. So this is truly patient-centered care. And in our industry, with the amount of money we spend on healthcare, I'm sure we can figure this one out. And so by doing team-based care at the home with intelligence, it'll bring down the price of healthcare because you're just less ER trips, less urgent care, less overutilization, less testing, more proactive, and it's better, safer care. That's where you're going to see it. Do you know one whole floor of the U.S. Steel Building is a call center? Anyone know this? Giant inbound, outbound call center watching every single thing, making sure your care is coordinated. They donate practice-based care managers to sit in your primary care doctor's office to coordinate your care. That can be done with telemedicine. So it's a way of, this is not a UPMC infomercial, it's just, this is what healthcare should be like, but this is just the beginning. Do you know what Kaiser, for example? Kaiser has a doctor like me, and you know, we're paid money, we're paid a lot of money. And they say to a physician, a specialist, you can't work this day, you sit there, and which is interesting, and you're supposed to take a consult at any time on the fly. So if you go to see a primary care doctor and they find a lesion, a skin lesion, and they're not sure, you can call a dermatologist immediately from the PCP's office. And the dermatologist looks at it and says, yes, no, biopsy, no. If they really don't know, they send you right to the dermatologist's office. They don't say, here's a number to call. They don't say, call you back. That's the way healthcare should be. It's faster, more proactive, better coordinated care, and that will bring down the price of healthcare. It's great, great stuff all around this country. Yes?
You mentioned a chip that's injected. Is that technology out there now? Can you, or you know, do you see something down the line for that? Could you expand on that idea some, please?
That's a little bit of Watson futurism there. Caught me on that one. But the only place I really have seen it in dogs. So I'm not saying you folks are dogs, nor am I a dog, but it just makes sense. It's just logical. And a lot of the innovation that we see in development is just pure logic. And my Lord, our phones have all this information, and there's radio frequency ID badges. So I do think there'll be a consumer market that will come up for this. The barrier to this right now are the electronic health records. We're still trying to get these big companies to play together. Some of the biggest health record companies don't talk to each other. But consumers of the future, someone's going to crack this nut, and they're going to want to do this. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I haven't seen it on the market, though, yet, just so you know.
This has been a great presentation. With the telemedicine, when would the intervention be to insert into the patient's home a scale for weight to see if they're congestive heart failure, blood pressure monitoring? When do you see that next layer of overlay, whether it be for physician monitoring or perhaps home health nursing monitoring? That's the question of when does that then piggyback rather than operating in silos.
So the question is, when are you going to see the devices under the houses? Anyone heard of Qualcomm? Interesting. I don't know much about them. I'm on their advisory board, so impressive. So when I join their advisory board, I don't take money for this, by the way. I don't do that. I'm also on Verizon's advisory board. I'm also on the board of the American Telemedicine Association. I should have put my disclosures up earlier. And Qualcomm sent me a little cardboard box. It sat there for about a month. And I was busy. So my 9-year-old daughter, in a fit of curiosity, got into this thing. And, of course, I found it all over the place with her birds and cats. And I plugged this device into the wall that flashed green, 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 and then lit up blue. And there was a scale, a blood pressure cuff, and a spirometer. I made a pulse oximeter. The scale was a little depressing. Maybe it needs to be calibrated. But I stood on the scale. I took my blood pressure. I got my pulse ox. In 3 minutes, that was online. Zero setup. So, and getting back to the other lady's question, remote monitoring is critical because these phones, you can put strips on you that measure your adrenaline level, your heart rate, your oxygen saturation. They'll get glucose transcutaneous. You can just shine it and figure out your sugar without pricking your finger. That's coming fairly soon, and probably your blood pressure too. And you're going to be pouring data out of your bodies. And we will be prescribing apps and monitoring, not medications. The problem is who looks at that, and that's what we have not figured out. And there's a large segment of our society that does not want to look at that because we don't get paid for it. But when you go to capitated-based payment, which is good, we're paid based on the health of our population, not based on how many surgeries Watson can do here, people will say it behooves us to watch patient data at home. And the patient will say, this is what I want released. But if you told me, hey, you could watch my heart rate and my weight and my oxygen saturation, I'd be up for that. I had I had two open heart surgeries when I was about 33 or something. I forget the exact age. And the way I found out was I put a saturation meter on my finger and said my number was 91. It's supposed to be 100. And my wife was a cardiologist, was practicing tests on me. And she says, hey, good test, but who's the patient? That's my husband. So we found out a month before I got married. But I'll tell you, those sorts of things save lives no matter what age you are. It's the real deal. And these remote monitoring devices, when you buy a TV, or your mother, or your father, or your son, or your daughter, if you had a sick son or daughter, and they bought a TV, would you pay $20 a month to have their health monitored? You bet you would. This will be a consumer-based activity. They're going to do it through Costco. And by the way, every American lives within 18 minutes of a Walmart. Did you know that? Oh, by the way, Walmart's going to get into healthcare. And when you go to the counter and they start managing risk of healthcare through Walmart, they're going to say, don't buy that. Maybe you should buy this. By the way, our pharmacy's back there. Have a Target. So watch out. That's real insurance, by the way. That's unbelievable.
Hi. Yes. You've emphasized medicine and computers this evening. I would be very interested in your ideas about another problem that a lot of people do see. With medicine keeping many, many more people living longer, you gave a little hint as to where robots are going there. So you've apparently talked to people at CMU, and maybe doctors are going to be a rare factor soon in terms of just labor factors. In any case, robots are taking certainly more and more of the load, the workload, from humans. In the meantime, I'm sure that most of you are aware of the population explosion. I mean, it's used to be going like this, and now it's going up in a straight line. And there's a lot of other things that I haven't mentioned in terms of prolonging life and saving more people, as well as wars that are lessening in a way, and et cetera, et cetera. What are your thoughts about this? What's happening? What's going to happen 100 years from now in terms of the way the population is going and robots are coming on?
Hard to know. I honestly can't tell what's going to happen in 2 months in healthcare. Hopefully the websites will work and the robots will fix it. I do think they call it the silver tsunami in Japan, by the way, and that if you look at the demographics of Japan, I think it's going to be 50% of the population will be over 65. I got to check my numbers. It's way up there. You'll see, as patients live longer, more proactive care and a much better dependence upon technology just to maintain your health. And so why would you have to go to a physician or a nurse for a school physical or a well check or screening? So you'll see patients be able to live longer and live healthier lives and not have to travel, because a lot of this can be done at home or at senior centers or at mobile vans. But you'll see healthcare leave the hospitals and offices and go back to the patients when and where they want it. How we manage an aging population is a different conundrum. And I think we're going to have to understand genomes and analytics to better understand it. And that'll be a real challenge for us. But that's more of a societal issue than a healthcare issue. You're right, CMU is a leader in robotics. There's a good friend of mine named Sanjeev Singh who is one of the robotic leaders there. And he invented the automated flying helicopter and has a startup. I do think you'll see a large role for some degree of automation of healthcare with robots. Is it going to be like the Terminator? I don't know. But you will see procedures, interventions, to some degree being done by them in the future. Right now, we're just understanding the beginning parts of that. Maybe Asimov was right. Is that good enough? It's a hard question, to be honest with you. I don't know. I don't know. Look at the United Auto Workers in welding car frames with robots. I don't know. I don't know what that means, but it's a issue of a lot of people on this planet, and the work will be very different in the future. Who knows? I just don't know.
Hi, and thank you for your presentation. My question is, with all of this advanced digital medicine, how much, if any, of our healthcare is going to be outsourced out of this country to save on the cost, rather than just amongst us and our doctors, but between doctors and...
Yeah, it's a great question, is how... It's the outsource question, and there's a fear in that. And to put it in perspective, two-thirds of radiology in the United Kingdom is outsourced right now. Radiology is very easily outsourced. I think the United States will always have the ability to control licensing and credentialing of physicians. Right now, our states, if I go to Ohio, I can't practice medicine without a license, more or less doing it from India, where my wife and her family are from. So there will always be some constraints between countries on licensing, which is really the big thing that people do to maintain it. I do think as the geography melts away and these artificial boundaries melt away, you'll be met with consumers that want to get good health care. We were in India about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. My wife's uncle had a heart attack. They made him pay, or the family pay, $5,000 when he came. And by the way, that covered anesthesia, his ICU, his rehab, his open heart surgery, all of his medications, and they charged him $200 for his balloon pump, and the guy's fine. So when patients are forced to pay for their own health care, they will seek the lowest price point available, and that might be in the Grand Caymans or medical tourism or somewhere else. So the patients are naturally going to migrate away from expensive systems. You're already seeing this in California right now. They're building a world-class hospital in the Grand Caymans, funded through money coming out of India right now, because the results are just as good as American healthcare systems at a fraction of the cost. And there's an entire article in the Harvard Business Review about this. It was last month. The bottom line is the consumers, if they got to pay for it, will find the lowest price point. And if it's here, great. If it's somewhere else they can get there, they'll do it. Yeah, some. But it puts pressure on us to do it better and be more efficient about it. It makes us better as a system. Physicians in other countries many times are just as good as us, but it makes us better. It does, because we can't just sit on our haunches and think that we're able to do it. There's not much of it being outsourced right now because of licensing. If you're a Commonwealth country, Canada, United Kingdom, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, it's easier. The United States is different about it. Correct. They have to get a different license. We can't practice in the European Union. Yeah. There's quasi ways around it, but it's not very effective. So fear not. It's not like we're going to export it, but it's actually good for our system and good for the consumers. It's better for you than it is for me, put it that way, as a doctor.
Yeah. You touched upon some of the ways that medical education will change with this new digital era. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the changes you expect to see from the medical school education level through residency, through actually seeing one of our students become a doctor using this technology. In addition, if you could also touch on how well you think that adoption would be, as well as any advice you have to students who might be interested in seeking a career in medicine in this digital age.
Healthcare and education are the holdouts with the digital era. And healthcare is being steamrolled by it currently. And education, I'm on the board of my daughter's school, Ellis, and I absolutely love Ellis. It's a great school. And I watch what they're doing with digital learning and e-classrooms and Haiku, and I watch, it's almost inverted learning to some degree at Ellis, where my daughter does all the schoolwork at home and then goes in there and reinforces it in the school. So the teachers are recording videos through Haiku and giving it to her at home. That's the way it should be. And anyone heard of the Khan Academy? Khan Academy? Look at the 60 Minutes on Khan Academy. That's amazing. This is all e-learning and digital learning. And it's a way of people could have access to health, have access to education no matter where you are, and collaborate no matter where you are. So it is going to revolutionize medical education and certainly medical training of some specialties. How far it goes, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm a little out of touch with that domain. I think that there's a very traditional approach to education that still exists in many medical schools, but it's changing. I think in the future you'll see virtual medical schools. I think anytime you're going to go in a field like I do, I was trained by experience. I can draw blood from a stone. I can get a central line into anybody. I can open up your belly in about, 10, 20 seconds. I mean, it sounds great, but it's not pretty. In the future, it will be based on my manual dexterity. You can wear gloves that measures the acceleration of your joints. And the more you go in and out and the more you move your hands, a master surgeon moves it directly, does it, and gets back. If you wash your hands, move in the OR, it's very precise movements. And they'll measure who's good and who's bad, and who could be advanced, who should be held back for remedial training based on the path length of the instruments, the acceleration, and the amount of jitter and white noise in their movements. So it will make the training more precise and better with much better simulation so you don't learn on the patients. There's a quote from the ex-chairman of surgery from a huge medical institution in Michigan who said, "The graveyards of Ann Arbor are filled with my education." That sums up the way it was done. And that will go away. I'm not saying anything about any institution anywhere in the country, but that was kind of the model that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. They did it to themselves in the 1600s. They ate stuff and said, what happened? They had a seizure. Don't eat that anymore. That was the era of enlightenment. That all happened at Oxford, actually, with Christopher Wren and Hooke and Boyle. These guys are crazy. They drank each other's urine. They did all sorts of wild stuff. But that's how they learned. They put straight whiskey into the back leg of a dog, and the dog fell over, and they said, there must be a heart circulating something in there because the thing's drunk. So, but then that's how we learn, was experimentation. In this new world, we'll learn through what we've done in the past. Very interesting times coming. I don't know how far this is going to go, though.
Hi. I'm coming from a little bit of a perspective related a little bit with the last person who asked a question, because I just finished my MA in educational technology. I want to get into the field of healthcare. And right now what I'm seeing is, like, because I look at the bigger picture that's going on, and we spend a lot of time on taking care of the damage that's already done. It's always damage control. And I'm thinking about more like systemic changes related with preventative care and people having like feedback on their lifestyle habits and education through mobile and social media and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, what will the role of healthcare plus education plus technology be in the coming years for a professional like me who's just budding in the field?
It's a good question. The compound world is real time. That you will see a world in real time coming at you. And that in education and healthcare, people have real time feedback on how they're doing from a health standpoint. From a caloric intake to an activity level like a Fitbit does to your sleep. And also to your vital signs. They use the adjective vital because they are vital. You need them. So if your heart rate starts going up, or your saturation starts going down, your blood pressure starts falling, you'll know in real time. So you'll see a tremendous push towards real time. It's hard. We don't fully understand it. Anyone heard of Leonard Sachs, who writes about education? Very interesting. He's a great speaker. And he talks about he came to, actually Allison gave a talk called The Facebook Ate My Daughter. I think that was the talk of it. And he was talking about social media, which is the largest public experiment we've ever run on a generation of children ever in the history of civilization, of exposing them to social media. So I don't know what's going to happen. There's a bad side to it and a good side to it, but there's also a real-time side to it. And the thing I think is most promising about social media is that people can help each other. If you can do it anonymously, and if you want to have an avatar or a health coach, it could be a peer like you who has the same disease that can help you through your own disease. So you see much more collaboration across boundaries, maybe between countries, with diseases, but most of this will be real time. What that means, who knows? But boy, that's a fascinating one. It's a great field, by the way, to be in healthcare. I love everything that I do. I'm not sure I'll have a job in 2 years, but I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. As like the others, I wanted to thank you for taking time from your schedule and presenting such an interesting and entertaining presentation. My question relates to the relationship between electronic medical records and personal health records. I looked at the model you presented showing the records as they would exist from an institutional perspective or from UPMC's perspective, so for a whole health system. And I look at that, and then I look at that as the patient, from the patient. And I see that as one piece of my data. Yep. And then I've got some of my data at several other sites. And the other thing that I note as I look at my data, and as I ask for this data, sometimes it comes paper, sometimes it comes electronic, is that it's not always accurate either. Mm-hmm. The data needs scrubbed. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as people begin to say, give me my data, and look at what it means and confront the system with that. What do you see, or do you see a model for how healthcare systems can be proactive in engaging patients in scrubbing that data and becoming more engaged in their health and directing their own health?
That is a great question. The world of healthcare, electronic health records, is very, very challenging. There are two monstrous companies, big companies in size, Epic and Cerner. And everyone's going to Epic right now. And then Intermountain just went to Cerner, which kind of shocked the world. So Kaiser went to Epic, and then the Harvard system called Partners, which is the parent GPO company, went to Epic as well. When Intermountain went to Cerner, it's like, But these companies don't talk. They do not exchange records. So as we get into installing EHRs and using them, we're installing silos right now. And I've got to be careful for a variety of reasons, but I think you can tell from the tone of my voice what my thoughts are. And there is no viable personal health record out there, which is just, I don't understand that. I just don't as a doctor. It just is beyond me. There are lots of people looking at this, and there's someone from CMU here, and people at Pitt, but CMU is really looking at these sorts of interoperability issues. How do you make these clinical systems talk to one another? And it is a challenge. Until we have a full-blown, wide-open personal health record that could go in a chip on your neck, I think we're going to have a major challenge. And you're right. Until the patients can get access to their own data freely and scrub it, make sure the data hygiene is there, is a big issue. Because you would be stunned at how many patients come to my office that don't know their primary care doctor, their medications, their problem list, or nothing. It's about two-thirds. So it is a big issue. This is a select crowd here, and a lot of folks don't. And I just, so you know, and again, that it's UPMC is not working with one electronic health record company. We are holding out trying to use multiple companies because we believe you can ride on top of them. If you get beholden to one company like an Epic or a Cerner, you're in their grasp. And we are using Cerner, Epic, Varian, and DB Motion, trying to make these work so we can work on top of them so we can not get into one of these giant silos. It's not an easy problem to solve right now. At some point, we'll have a good personal health record. I can't wait. That's a great question. I think that'll be a big turning point for our country. We have a big personal health record. And by the way, Google tried, and they pulled out of it. I don't quite understand that one. I don't know enough about that. So, yeah.
This really is interesting. One thing that I wonder, though, is I keep tripping over the health insurance companies and the practice of another company contracting with them for a special rate, and gods, no mind can ever figure that out. But UPMC, because it is both, are you figuring it out? In other words, are you able to take your UPMC insurance and adjust it to the televised in-home group service to a patient? And as a patient, do I know? I mean, I'm going to come in and say, hey, if you're going to do this to me, how much is it going to cost? Can you tell me? Because everybody has a different level of insurance, and nobody really knows. I mean, you know, that wonderful article that was in, was it Time Magazine last year? And the guy...
I mean, the charge master.
Yeah. He called up the same hospital four times to ask about how much it was going to cost to do so-and-so, and they got four different figures, so... Yeah.
Surprising to get five.
Well, maybe it was five. I can't remember. At any rate, how are we going to make, as a patient? And another question.
It's a great question. Let me turn on my phone because I want to answer with my phone.
Oh, yeah, okay. I have your insurance and your company, but I'm in South Dakota with all that teleconferencing and everything, but I get sick. Can you, as a patient, as my doctor here in Pittsburgh, treat me there even though you're not licensed in Pennsylvania? Or is there any coordination between that? I mean, I want, as a patient, I want to go anywhere in the United States with my insurance. Thank you.
So the insurance question, this is a national issue. The healthcare reform as you see it today is insurance reform. So this is one of my favorite friends who is brilliant. He's a radiologist here, and I have enormous respect for him. He also is the funniest dog I've ever seen in my entire life. He has a lovely wife who's very proper, and this dog brings dead possums and puts it on her lovely furniture. And this dog is really, it's like got a life of his own. And I told my daughter about the dog, and she wanted to go meet the dog, and the dog suddenly peed in their vegetable garden, so she no longer eats salads. So, that one backfired. They give their vegetables away, and she would kill me if she knew I was saying this, and she hopefully doesn't find this. So this is him. He's one of the most well-read people I've ever met, too. Texted me today at, what time is this, 2:35. Hey, did you look at the health plans yet? HSA plan is apparently the best for us, but I'm wary of it and want to get your take on this. Talk to a good benefit person because it seems they don't all understand it. Hey, November 15th, when you have to do this by, it takes a couple of days to register, so you may want to do this. It'll cost you about $2,000. I mean, these are the texts we're getting from our peers about insurance, and these are very savvy physicians doing this sort of texting right now, trying to figure this out. Insurance reform will become clearer with time. Insurance is a personal issue, it's a national issue, and it's also an employer issue. And so when these exchanges work, and they'll work fine, and healthcare.gov will work fine. Remember, the Ford Pinto didn't work so well up front, and now these cars work fine. We have gas tanks in the back. And the Tesla's having a little problem, but that'll go away too. Insurance reform is about understanding the cost of healthcare. So when you buy healthcare, you want to understand the cost and what you get from it. The problem in healthcare is you don't understand what you get for that money right now because you don't understand the clinical performance. That's why analytics is so important. Once the analytics say, am I good? Are my surgeries good? Are my outcomes good? My length of stay is good? My leak rate minimal, when my bowel connections connected, they don't leak. When you put the outcomes to the cost, you'll understand value. That's why analytics is so important. So right now with insurance reform, we understand measures, the initial measures about how much healthcare costs. So you will see a lot of shifting about some companies said we can do it for this much and some that much and some. This will eventually calm down. You'll have probably less payers than you have now. And consumers will have a lot more intelligence about what they're buying. Because here to now, we just got insurance through our employers. It was kind of blindly buying insurance. But through high deductible accounts, people are very aware of how much these things cost, as my friend was texting. And it will force the people selling insurance to be very transparent about telemedicine. You know, many insurance companies give away the telemedicine encounters, those portals. So if you have an urgent care issue, and you go online, instead of charging you $40 to see a nurse to say, I've got a sore throat, can you send me a script, versus going to an ER or a doctor, they give it away. It behooves them to give it away. So when you sign up, it'll say, as part of your benefit design, you get free telemedicine at home or at work. So yes, you'll see it. Yes, it'll be available. Yes, it's part of it. Yes, we're doing it. Yes, other commercials are doing it throughout the country. It's a big deal. So it's just time before we as consumers get a better handle on this. Telemedicine will help the cost. It's a very hard question to answer, and I apologize, I can't be any clearer than that. Does that make sense? A little bit? Okay. Insurance reform is will get clearer with time.
You had mentioned that UPMC currently uses 4 different electronic medical record systems and that there are various advantages to doing that. What are the disadvantages to doing that, such as with our physicians having to enter things in multiple times, pulling up, and what is the lag time in between using those multiple systems? And what is the goal of actually holding out? Is it to try and figure out how to integrate the system, or is it to figure out which one is going to work best for the patient population served by UPMC?
The strategy is best of breed, that you want to make sure that you always have the best technology available to our patients. And so I don't know if there's lag time or not. The downside is that sometimes you have to, it's a different workflow in Cerner versus Epic, and it is hard for us sometimes, sure it is. But we have our technology development centers working to solve that. There'll be something called convergence on top. With an iPad, you get one single view. It doesn't matter what record, where you are, what system, what hospital, this is what you got. And it also means health information exchanges where multiple hospitals join these big networks, and all of your records will be swapped through those as well. Because it's not just UPMC, Cerner, and Epic. What happens if I get a huge workup here at UPMC, and I drive, or Allegheny Health Network, and I drive up north, I get into a car accident near my farmhouse, end up in Indiana? They don't use Cerner, they don't use Epic. I don't know what they use, actually. They could use one of them. I don't think they do. What if I ended up in Nason or Punxsutawney? They don't use those big ones. So it's not a Cerner Epic issue. It's really you've got to make sure you don't get beholden to one, that you maintain the information. And that is a big deal. We're the only healthcare system right now to have mapped all these terms between the records. If you call it penicillin, he calls it cephalosporin, and I call it amoxicillin, what am I allergic to? You've got to line all these terms up. And that's part of the challenge. It's a huge conundrum right now that we're working through. This too shall pass. Hopefully with a PHR.
The digital era, as you describe, it really lends itself to team care. But what's happening to change the culture among doctors to have team care?
Uh-oh. It's hard for us as an industry. It is. We were used to a certain way, and it's changing. And what we're doing now is a lot of this is through you give doctors feedback. So I get feedback on my quality, and my patient satisfaction scores are emailed to me, and those start to affect how much I get reimbursed. And then you have to start with the culture of healthcare in your organization. Our chief quality officer, Tammy Minier, is amazing. I just spoke to her tonight. She's just amazing. And our new Dr. Shapiro, who runs our physician services division, these are people that believe in a different culture, and it has to be part of the fabric of your organization. And for us, it's a top-down. It's no different than Kaiser or Intermountain. Intermountain's putting telemedicine in every room. They want a camera in every room watching their patients. That's amazing. And then you also start tying the expense of care to the outcomes of care, and you tell the provider, hey, this is what you did. What do you think? That's interesting, because when you get that real-time feedback that we've never had before, I get emailed my OR times now. Wow, that's a little spooky. So you have to start with feedback is the first step, but eventually you're going to get down to real brass tacks through analytics saying, this person can do it for half the cost and half the risk as you. Either you talk to him or you can go somewhere else. And sadly, that's across the country. I'm not saying it's a UPMC or an Allegheny Health Network mantra. That's just going to be an issue across the country. The cultural change is hard. If you want to read about cultural change, read Atul Gawande. Look at how you handle plane flights and how you handle the cockpits and things like that. The Checklist Manifesto is a great book, by the way, by Atul Gawande, G-A-W-A-N-D-E, The Checklist Manifesto. It is a great book. It is a great, great book. You should all read it if you like healthcare. Cultural change is a very hard subject.
And building on that...
And by the way, sorry, one more thing. They do allow me to come speak, which is important. I'm not like I'm kept in a cage or a pen. But the fact that they support nurses and doctors to think differently and be different, and we've got the Technology Development Center, and many folks are looking at this. This is one of the most innovative companies because we have to be. We don't want to be BlackBerry. We don't want to be another Dell. We don't want to be another, you know, Microsoft lost the market to Apple in a lot of ways. You know, just talking to my mom about her computer. They went to the Apple store. They fixed it. They told her what was wrong, and they gave it back to her for free. She scheduled the appointment the same day. That's amazing customer service. We're not used to that in healthcare, but we will be very soon. Mm-hmm. That is a country. Yes.
Do we have some special challenges here because of the demographics being the second oldest county, Allegheny, in the country? Do you see this moving forward for more gerontology medicine and going to work with the Medicare risk programs? Is it going to be based there and then go into commercial? And then also the challenge with the dial-up phones, is that technology? I think we also have one of the highest rates of the old-fashioned phones here. So just curious about that. And then the last piece, there are portions within Pennsylvania that will never accept the health insurance, the Amish community. So how do we see, you know, this may be overlaying for them, and especially since they're so technology kind of shy or in barring that from their communities? Sorry that I jumped around.
So I tried to actually get a picture of an Amish buggy. I had a problem with my little farmhouse, and I drove up there, and I drove past an open Amish buggy and a hack yesterday. And on Saturday, my wife and daughter and I went up to our little Amish house and saw the buggies go by, and they were almost done picking corn. And they just don't believe in having pictures taken of themselves, and they just won't go to telemedicine clinics. And that's just a component of their religious beliefs, and that's, there's nothing we can do, and that's just who they are. And they've always, yeah, this. Yeah, and they, but they're actually very good about paying for it. Most of them are, paying for it. The issue of technology and people don't use it, and that's just, there are aspects of society that won't use technology that are built-in Luddites, shall we say. But what we've noticed and what I've certainly seen and what really caught me off guard with telemedicine was that if someone didn't want it, like an elderly person, like a cell phone or a tablet or something, their daughter or son did because of pure survival. So if somebody was recalcitrant and didn't want it, there's someone right beside them, a sister, brother, son, daughter, that would do all of it on the tablets or phones. So there are very few people left that really say no to all this stuff. There's someone around them that will actually use it. And you don't have to. You can still come to the hospitals. The doors are still open. So it's, but when the elderly generation realizes they don't have to travel, they're right on this stuff. Because travel is real pain. Yeah, literally, too. Good questions.
You had mentioned that a lot of the health insurance plans in the United States are moving towards more of a telemedicine approach. And I know some insurances are even saying, you know, we are going to provide nurses as nurse coaches to help you through things on the phone and are looking to add video presence or that telemedicine presence. What encouragement do I have as a health insurance consumer to use that versus going to see my doctor? In other words, why should I entrust a nurse employed by my health insurance to tell me what to do, what not to do? How do I know that they're not going to have a bias towards pretty much what's going to keep the insurance cost down and maximize their profit?
Mm-hmm. Well, they call it the medical loss ratio is the term, and it's the profit margin is a polite way of saying it. But the federal government does put restrictions upon profit margins on most people that use Medicare, Medicaid, and all commercial products, United, WellPoint, Cigna, Aetna, will very carefully track Medicare and Medicaid. So there is a profit margin that's sort of closely agreed upon with the gentleman's handshake in the insurance world. And insurers will pay for telemedicine because it's easier and it's cheaper and it's faster for patients. So they will begin to reimburse for this over time. It is just a matter of time. And as a consumer, you have to have faith at some point in the care that you're getting and that you will see with time that the rise of analytics will show you the quality of care that you're getting. Because right now you really don't know. You have to sort of trust us, shall we say. But with time, as you look at the outcomes of plans and you look at the performance of plans and healthcare systems, you'll know. By the way, who buys insurance? Who's the biggest purchaser of insurance? Government. And who's the second biggest one? Federal government obviously buys, but after that, IBM, Verizon, GE, they can't afford insurance. Incredible. They can't afford their insurance anymore. Those folks are going to get right in the face of the delivery system and the insurers and saying, show me the value for healthcare, and the consumers will benefit from that. So I'm glad that these commercial entities are up and doing this right now. Good questions.
Okay, I have another question.
Sure.
We're talking a lot about sharing information, but I'm wondering about sharing knowledge and skills that can transfer out into the real world from the digital, because you said, you know, there's training and tele-education and stuff like that with medicine. But how do you ensure that someone actually has the skills if they've only learned it at a distance?
So with virtual e-learning, you can understand if people have it. They'll be certified. Like, I'm board certified in surgery, and I'm actually not board certified in colorectal surgery, but I'm a master colorectal surgeon. Board certification, training, and the insurers are going to watch this very carefully, because if you're not very good, the insurers are going to shut you down and not pay you for it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of inherent checks and balances within our system to make sure people are good. And through the use of e-learning, videos, remote training, and video teleconferencing are all ways you can ensure people are good at doing what they do. So the system is actually very well designed to corral itself.
Okay. So. This also relates to the use of AI for diagnoses and things like that. How would one ensure then that it's accurate?
So artificial intelligence will help get you there and confirm what you're thinking. It may not make the diagnosis per se, but it'll be a Sherpa guide. Because we do get tired. I operated about 3 months ago, 39 hours in a row. And you definitely get tired at the end, and all those folks did fine. But it's nice to have a computer that doesn't bitch and complain and want time off work and doesn't want M&Ms or take a pee break. They're constantly saying with performance, it's like welding a car frame in the service line. This is what we think is going on, watching, watching, watching. So artificial intelligence, is it going to be the Terminator to take over the world? No. Will it be a phenomenal, powerful Sherpa guide? Yes. But what's most interesting about artificial intelligence is that it aggregates over time intelligence, and it turns knowledge into wisdom and then into prescriptive medicine. So that's what you're going to see. All of the wisdom over time will be collected and aggregated, which is good. Especially for cancer care is a very good one in Crohn's, like what I do.
Okay. That last point that you're talking about collective intelligence, I'm sure you've heard of the slime mold theory.
The what theory?
The slime mold example of collective intelligence. Like, the slime mold is the only organism where each cell is a leader. Like, there's no central nervous system. And they tend to work as individual cells or as an actual whole organism, depending on the environmental conditions they're in. So people are actually taking this and applying it to networks. So that just made me think of that. But I'm just thinking, like, with what you're talking about, changing information to wisdom, there's a lot of steps there, and one of them is meaning making. And we're taking information from people's heads, data. But how, because I took a knowledge management course, and the professor was like, well, we changed it from, nowadays we just call it information management, because the knowledge point piece isn't there anymore. The meaning isn't there. So how do you expect that to to survive in the digital, because it's people that make meaning?
I honestly don't know. I think that the computers and the artificial intelligence will be able to understand at least what was done and what was the outcome and constantly react to that. We do it every day in our lives, and it's just going to aggregate that over time and become more and more honed with what we see and what we do. It's a very complex question, but it's I think with time it's just going to collect experiential data and not let it go away. So, and that's going to give us a giant database to fall back upon. But interesting. I got a new theory to read about tonight. Not too much geek talk tonight, I hope. No.
Yes. How do other countries organize their telemedicine and their data records? If you have a single payer system in France, I believe they can carry their information on a credit card, which they carry with them all the time. So how are other countries solving the same problem?
With telemedicine or just in general? With telemedicine or in general?
In general.
This is a ubiquitous problem throughout the world. If you have a national healthcare system, you can certainly try it. The United Kingdom's had enormous challenges in this domain. They tried a central one. I think it was $20 billion they spent, or pounds. I forget the number. It was staggering how much money, $22 billion. They tried to do it. It didn't work. There have been efforts in other countries. Each country has its own problems, and no one has quite solved this. The digital era crept up on us and kind of tackled us, and so we're reacting to it. If the keys to being successful, though, are having a national provider identification number, which we do have, but we don't have a national patient identifier number like Australia has or Taiwan has. And so having at least unique identifiers per patient are important starts. Because, again, when patients come into the ER, you've got to make sure who is that patient before you trigger the system. If you come into our system as a trauma, God help you, don't, and we got the wrong date of birth or the wrong address, and we listed all these things you didn't have and started down the pathway, that's a problem. So having a unique patient identifier is a critical first step, and then how you broker the data and feed the data and consume the data through software packages, and then how do you move it back to the patients is another. No one quite has this right now. It's very confusing. A credit card is one thing, but what happens if it's hacked? What if you lose it? Is it real? What's that? The cloud could, but you'd be amazed at the security of the clouds that we run. It's really very scary, the security of these clouds, in a good way. They really watch these things closely. Read about dark market. That's incredible. Actually done here in Pittsburgh about how the FBI and the financial identity theft. Incredible story called Dark Market. It's in the papers a long time ago, 5 years ago. But no one has it. We're working on it. Don't know where that's going to go. It will work itself out, I guarantee you. There's too much market pressure for it not to. Thank you all for your time tonight. They're great questions.